All right. As you are finding your seats, just a show of hands, I did this last week, but I think a lot of people were out of town. Who's going to be around for the Christmas weekend? And so we'll be in town? Okay, so a handful of us. So Christmas Day lands on a Sunday, and we're going to move the liturgy to Saturday night. And I think it'll be beautiful. We're going to have a meal together, come celebrate Eucharist, and I'm excited for it. So Mick and Sue has graciously offered to host, and so we'll get an invite out and an address in the next coming weeks. All right? One quick thing. I wanted to just share something about some changes we've made with Space 12 and the relationship to Vox. And so I thought it might be helpful for a lot of people who might not know the story. And so the short version kind of goes like this. We started the church in 2006, and so we had a Vox, which was a circle. And our hope was that as we were learning and wrestling with what does it mean to be a church, and what is the church's posture in relationship to the city and neighborhood, we were really wanting whatever space we were in to be helpful to the surrounding community. At that time, our offices were in 501 Studios, where Progress Coffee is, which was kind of nice and comfortable, but just not very accessible to the surrounding neighborhood and useful. And so we moved out, not really knowing what would happen, and then we stumbled across this building. And my first thought was, this building looks affordable. Let's take it, right? So it kind of looked like this. That was the back room. A couple more pictures. And so our community, it was really exciting. The community jumped on and said, yes, this could be the place where we could learn to be a church. And so we renovated it. There was 5 layers of drywall, molded carpet, condoms, vodka bottles, cockroaches. We found a few exciting flyers Sunday nights. This was happening here. And we said this would be the perfect place to be a church. So what we did was we created a separate organization. We created another 501c3. The umbrella organization, we called it Austin City Spaces. The main reason for that is we don't own the building. And we figured the name of the building is based on the street that it's on. So if later we had to move, it would be strange to call it Space 12. So we called the overarching organization Austin City Spaces, but they're one and the same. We also created it as a non-faith-based organization. The hope was this, that we would create another face as a community center for the neighborhood, and it would offer kind of a less threatening means to meet the neighbors and community. And then the other side of it was, too, that maybe if there were grants and donors, that it might open more doors for that. Okay. While that was happening, a bunch of families that had been living all over the city were really trying to wrestle with neighborhood, parish, community, sharing. And then about 15 families kind of sold their homes, moved in within a mile radius of Space 12. At that time, there was an attorney who was a part of our community and graciously said, hey, if you guys are doing this, I'd like to buy 2 homes in that neighborhood so people in Vox could do it with you. And so that was the birth of 297. And so there's 2 homes, and we've had a few generations of community people who've lived in those homes, and we let them establish the values and the vision. And they said, this is the goal, this is the vision, to redistribute. So a big part of the rent that comes in goes back out to the neighborhood. We challenge the people who live in those homes, hey, you've got all this money saved up now. How are you going to use it to bless the neighborhood? Communal living in a more intentional way, and then simple living. And the first generation of the house really said, we want to live simply. We want this to be bare bones. So while that was happening, we made the decision to kind of bring it under Austin City Spaces because we saw it as another space that could be a blessing to the city. Okay? So are you guys following? Yeah? Okay. So we have recently kind of gone back to the drawing board, and for a couple reasons, we've decided to move Austin City Spaces and 297 officially under Vox. And so legally, it's an auxiliary of Vox and of our community. The main two discussions was this. One, do we have the bandwidth to actually hire staff outside of our community to run Austin City Spaces? We think that'd be a viable model, but we're not sure we have the bandwidth for that right now. And we said, well, it'd be better if we just brought it under the church. And then the main discussion we had was this. If in 5-10 years, both 297 and Space 12 had nothing to do with Vox, if they were completely separate, would we be okay with that? And we said, no. You know, we feel that God had opened these doors for our community to serve the surrounding neighborhood and the city. And so that's our hope, that's the vision. And so now, officially, Austin City Spaces 297 is faith-based and an auxiliary of Vox as the church. Okay? So we just wanted everyone to kind of understand the relationship. I think when you're looking at the budget, some of the things might make a little more sense. Okay? But if you have any more questions, we encourage you guys to stick around and find out more and ask questions. Cool? All right. So the question for this morning, and I'd like to hear some of your responses, was what is your comfort food? Anybody? Meatloaf. Mm-hmm. Grilled cheese and tomato soup. All right, this is going to make us all hungry. Anybody else? Hey, don't judge. Don't judge other people's... I'm just kidding. Anybody else? Beans. Silas said beans. Is that a brother thing? Both of you? Beans? Yeah. Anybody else? Quesadillas. Something chicken? Bush's chicken. Uh huh. Coffee. Okay. Well, I thought about this question, and I had this ritual. So I went to high school and went to college in Toronto, and I would say my mom's actually here today. But when I was in high school, I did not make life easy for my family. I was challenging. Yeah, who does? But we'd have this moment every day, and it was just me and my mom. And she grew up in a really urban environment in Asia where nightlife was always vibrant. So you could walk down at any hour and get a snack. So that was kind of her thing, the midnight snack. And so in high school, my mom and I would have this moment where it'd be like 11, 11:30, and then both of us would kind of roll into the kitchen and then look at each other, and then we'd make a snack. It would be sometimes grilled cheese or ramen or just leftovers. And in hindsight, it was a really beautiful thing. You know, we'd have this moment, maybe 10, 15 minutes, just the two of us eating and then talking to each other. And so I think because of that, when life gets a little stressful for me, well, actually, even when it's not stressful, somewhere around 11 o'clock, I'll start wandering around the kitchen. And Karen knows it's coming. I'll just start opening the fridge, closing it, opening cabinets. She's like, midnight snack time? I'm like, kind of, right? And so for me, maybe my go-to comfort food is ramen. You know the Korean ones, the red packaging? And with a fried egg on top. So delicious. But usually around midnight, so not the greatest, right? But this morning, I wanted to talk and have a conversation about this idea of comfort, right? We live in a culture where we talk about comfort food, we have comfort shoes, we sleep with comforters. Do you like that? Do you like how I played those two words? But what does it mean then when in scripture this idea of comfort and God as our comforter is such a central, beautiful theme? You know, we're going to be in the book of Isaiah, and late in the book he talks about how God comforts us like a mother comforts her child, like a baby who's scared and helpless and weak and brings her in like a nursing mom. He talks about that. You know, David would write, you know, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear nothing because your rod and your staff, they comfort me. And this idea of comfort in this season of Advent as we're waiting, you know, I think for a lot of people, maybe some of us in this room, every time we open the mic and there's sharing and there's prayers, there's stories that are so hard and broken. And in this season of Advent, to wait and to find comfort. You know, I asked Noah's teacher, it was his kindergarten teacher, so it's been a couple years, but we kind of knew her. And I just randomly asked when I was picking him up, you know, you looking forward to Christmas? And her husband had passed away last year around this time. She said, no, I'm not. And we live in a city where people need comfort. And what does this mean then as we wait and we approach the one who offers us comfort? And so we'll be in the book of Isaiah, just a kind of a background about who he is. So he was one of the main prophets for four successive kings. So it would be like if he was a prophet, let's say he starts in the Reagan era, and then with Bush Sr., Clinton, and then Jr., right? So, but it would much longer because there's not 8-year terms. It's just like their entire life. And so Isaiah was the prophet during this time. He was a contemporary of Amos, Micah. He was a contemporary of Homer. So when the Iliad and the Odyssey was being written, this was around the same time. And so he pens this book that a lot of writers and historians think is the most formative Old Testament book out of all the prophets. And so we're going to be in that text. And so we'll be in chapter 40, and we have it on the screen. So go ahead and grab a friend next to you, read verse 1 through 5, and we're going to walk through it, and we're going to talk about this idea of comfort. All right? Go ahead and read. All right, let's pick this up in verse 1. So he writes now, "Comfort, comfort my people, says your God." Verse 2. "Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed and her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all of her sins." And so there's a few things going on here. Historians say there's this beautiful parallel between the book of Isaiah and another book. So in Isaiah, there's two sections. The first section is 39 chapters. The second section is 27. So a total, there's 66, which reminds you of the Bible, right? And so it's this beautiful book where there's 39 chapters where a large majority of it is talking about judgment. It's talking about sin. It's talking about communities and these people not living in the right way. And then this transition point comes now right after 39 at chapter 40. And then now that you realize your sin, now that you realize you haven't been living in the right way, he says now, comfort, comfort my people. And then in verse 2, Isaiah says, to speak tenderly. And then at the end of that, it says that she's received from the Lord's hand double for all of her sins. So this is what's happening. So Isaiah's gone through 39 chapters of, listen, the way you've been living is not right. That the song you've been singing is not right. You've got to understand that. If you don't understand that point, then the rest of the 27 chapters of redemption, of forgiveness, of beauty, of God being with you, of comfort, doesn't make sense. But if you do, if you get that, then there's comfort. And not only is there comfort, there's double repayment. This is what commentaries say. So not just double. So single would be all of the wrongdoing, your sin is forgiven. You're back to zero. Okay? You haven't been living in the right way. Now I'll bring you back to zero. The double blessing is now not only that, God gives you even more. And now this is the right way to live. This is how life was meant to be lived. And I think this is this beautiful transition here where if people realize that they haven't been living in the right way, then they repent. And then God goes, now look, this is how beautiful life was intended to be. If we'd been singing a song that's not the right song, he says, look, there's the beauty and the music that was intended for us to sing together. You know, it'd be like this. So when I was in middle school, I lived in Hong Kong. And in Hong Kong, what's fun is all your classmates got to choose their own English names in kindergarten, which makes a lot of sense because you now meet 7 million people who are named by things that you're into in kindergarten. So my two best friends were Snoopy, because Snoopy in kindergarten's pretty awesome, and Pillow. I kid you not. And then my sister's best friend was Money. She's now a rapper. And, but I remember we had this birthday party. So I think my sister's maybe 10, and she had all of her friends there. And you know, we had the cake, and you did like the little birthday games. And so the party was winding down. They'd open the gifts. And then my mom goes, oh, you know, Rachel's been, she's a wonderful piano player. She's got this great teacher. Rachel, would you like to play a song for everybody? She's like, okay. She sits down, and then she played her little song, and it was pretty awesome. And then, you know, everyone was like clapping, and like, it's her birthday, so it's the spotlight was on her. Like, wow, that was great. Like, good job. And then her friend Money, maybe she was jealous of that the spotlight wasn't on her, or maybe she thought her name was Money, so she just needs to perform as well. So she goes, I'm awesome too. And then she goes, I want to play a song. I'm really, really good. And then so all of us were like, oh, okay, yeah, go ahead. Go for it, Money, right? And so she sits down, and she looked like really good. Like she adjusted her chair, right? She had like great posture. She was like, you know, stretching, you know, and then she had this moment where she closes her eyes and she's about to go into it. And the way she was performing, we're like, she's got to be amazing, right? So she dives into her song with eyes closed. And you've probably seen toddlers who just sit at the piano and just start banging. So she starts doing that while swaying. And then at first we thought, oh, she's just kidding. She's going to stop and then play the real song. And then she goes on for like the full length of how long a song should be, for like 3 minutes. She's got her eyes closed and she's just like banging. And at some point we're like, wow, this is really like post-postmodern. This is like post-minimal classical music, right? So she ends her song and then everyone's kind of looking at each other and we're like, yay. That was awesome, Money, right? So let's say hypothetically that her dad was a world-renowned pianist, okay? Now let's say her dad, every time she sat down, and he knows how to play, he's the best in the world, sees her play, like just banging on keys, and goes to her, wow, that is unbelievable, that's perfect, you should keep doing exactly that. I think you could propose that that's maybe not the most loving thing he could do because he knows what the instrument was designed for and the beauty that it could create. And I think you could argue that in that moment, the loving thing to do would be to say, hey, that's not that good. In fact, it's quite bad. Let me explain to you why it's bad, but now I'm explaining it to you because I'm your dad and I love you. And I know the beauty that this instrument can create. And now I will spend the rest of my life helping you play a beautiful song. And it's as if in Isaiah, you come to this transition point. And we live in a culture that's so scared of talking about sin. And I think sin isn't a great conversation if it's an end in itself. But if the conversation about sin and the song that we're singing and the life that we're living is a means to grace, a means to forgiveness, and a means to this life that God intends. And Isaiah goes, comfort, comfort my people. You've been living in the consequences of these decisions you've made, and now I will repay this with double. You're going to be blessed. And you remember, one time, Jesus goes up to Simon, and he's with the 12, and then he just asks this question. Who do people say that I am? And they're like, John? Jeremiah? And then Jesus goes to Simon, who do you say that I am? He goes, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And he now goes to this guy who's completely uneducated, blue collar, and then he says to him, you know what? You're no longer Simon, but you're going to be the rock. We're going to call you Peter. And on this rock, I'm going to build the church. And now the thing, though, in that moment, he changes his name. But Peter was still kind of Simon. And he didn't realize how far he was from becoming the rock. And so in the very next conversation, Jesus goes, well, you're kind of like Satan right now. Like, get behind me, Satan, right? And then later on, he's talking about betrayal. He's like, I will never betray you, ever, right? Jesus is like, you will. Rooster's going to crow. And it, like, there's this process where he goes from Simon, but he still needs to understand how far he is from being the rock. And as he's confronted with that, as he's confronted that he's more of a betrayer, more of a denier, and the rooster crows, and now he's shown that his life was intended to be more than that, to lead, that one day thousands of communities around the world on the margins of cities will be led by your flawed person now made into beauty of who God designed us to be. And I think for us, I think we should be a community that talks about sin and conversion. I think we're so scared of like the altar call or the manufactured conversions that we don't talk about it anymore. But Isaiah, the first point when God calls him, his first response is, I'm a man of unclean lips. I'm not clean. I can't do that. And then once he comes to that realization, now there's this song that he learns to sing. And for us, it doesn't matter how much we know. It doesn't matter how missional we are. It doesn't matter how much community we're living in. Until we come to that point of realizing who we're not, and then we take the invitation to become who we're supposed to be. And then to have conversations of sin with each other as a means to grace and beauty. And so you have Isaiah, and he goes, speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed. Her sin has been paid for, and she's received from the Lord's hand double for all of her sins. Let's keep going. And then in verse 3, it says this, a voice of one calling in the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. This is so beautiful. Every valley shall be raised up. Every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level. The rugged places a plain. And so what historians say is there's a few things going on here. One, that first imagery of coming through and like preparing the way and then smoothing out roads, that's what you would do if royalty were coming into town. So it's kind of like, do you remember the opening scene of Marie Antoinette from Sofia Coppola, where she's going to meet her king, and it's such a beautiful, and they're traveling through. And it's kind of like that when royalty and the entourage is coming, they now pave the road to prepare the way. So everyone would have understood these are statements of royalty coming into town. But then the imagery that historians say now, he says every valley will be raised up, every mountain and hill made low. That means everything's going to be just. Those who don't have will have. Those who have too much power will be made low. And time again, the statement is for those in the valley, those in rugged places. And historians say this is the announcement that there will be good news to the poor, to the crippled, to the lame, to the underdogs. And then you fast forward all the way to the story of Advent, where everyone's expecting Jesus to come in power, in might, in royalty, and he comes in royalty as this baby, helpless into this world. And so, you know, at this point, I always think, well, why, right? Why is there this theme throughout Scripture for the orphan, the widow, the underdogs? Why is that? Did anyone listen to the recent episode of Radiolab about the underdog. So there's this one guy who just found himself always rooting for the underdog. And so he started watching college basketball and March Madness. He knew nothing about college basketball, so he thought everyone else was watching. He started watching. So he found himself just choosing the lower seed, and then he would root for the lower seed. And it was that one year, I don't know if you guys remember, was it last year or the year before, where Butler played Michigan State? Last year? Year before? Okay. But they ended up being the same seed, so he got confused. He didn't know who to cheer for. So during the game, he would just cheer for whoever was losing. And then it dawned on him that he's just setting himself up for failure because the loser will lose the game, right? And he was like, why am I doing this? And so there's been these studies in the University of Richmond and the University of San Diego where they would take these tests with undergrads and they would just propose any situation to them, like shapes. And then they would pose a shape to be an underdog, or they would do politicians, or any game. They didn't have to talk about what the game is. And eight, almost 9 out of 10 people would always root for the underdog. And their question was, why? Why would they do this? And so one theory is that it's kind of based on emotional economics. So if you root for the person who's supposed to win, they're probably going to win. And when they win, the emotional payoff isn't that great because they're kind of happy. But if the team that isn't supposed to win, the chances of them winning are lower. And when they actually win, when Villanova beats Georgetown, that emotional payoff is so great. And so some people say, maybe that's why we choose the underdog. But then they said, you know, maybe in human beings, deep down in all of us, there's this longing for justice. And that the ones who keep losing at some point get to win. And in scripture, maybe this idea is that it's in the image of God, justice, and we being created in the image of God. And you see time and time again for the weak, the poor, the lame. You know, Jesus tells a story of a guy who throws this big party. And so it's going to be the hottest party in town, but they don't have Evites or Facebook, so they send servants and go, hey, I picture the servant looking like Aziz Ansari. Like, party, right? There's going to be a party. And so he's like running around town, party time. And they're like, who wants to come? And then people are like, I'll come, right? And then, so you don't know what time because they don't have watches. And so the party just starts when the food is done. So they take the invitations and then they take a head count. They go, okay, this many people are coming. We'll prepare that much food. So when the food's done, they send Aziz back out into the neighborhood. Party time, right? The party's starting. So now he goes to people who said they would come, and then they give, like, ridiculous excuses. The first guy's like, I just bought land. And I'm going to check it out now. I can't come. And historians say no one buys land without checking it out. It's like buying a house without looking at it, right? They're just making excuses. Second guy's like, I just bought oxen. Can't come. Last guy doesn't even give a good excuse. He's like, I just got married. Can't come because I just got married, right? And then so he goes back and Aziz is like, they can't come. What's wrong, right? This is terrible. And then so the owner is furious. And then the story says, go to the streets and the alleys and bring in the crippled, the poor, the lame. Bring them in. And so they all start. You imagine the scene now? So there's this magnificent party that was planned for whoever wants to come. Now these people who are so busy, who have other things to do, they don't. And you imagine the crippled, the poor, they're crawling in. They're on wheelchairs. They're being like carried in. And then he looks around and he kind of sees the party and he says, you know what? But there's still more room. So go to the countryside. Let's go rural now. And tell everybody, he said, compel them all to come because I want this party in my house and this table to be full. And there's this sense that maybe comfort is for those who don't have the means to manufacture comfort for themselves and live in these valleys where they're forgotten and lonely And when everyone else is too busy, too powerful, has too much going on, and then he says, come, I want my house to be full. You know, and I pray that we'll be a community for underdogs. And a lot of us, we are, that's why we gather. And that we'll go comb the cities, the world, the streets, and that we'll bring this invitation in. And in this season of Advent, where Jesus doesn't come as a king in power with trumpets blaring, but as this powerless, weak baby. And Isaiah says, every valley will be raised up, every mountain and hill made low, the rough ground shall become level, and the rugged places a plain. And then he goes through for the rest of the text. He talks about God's power and might. He talks about all that he knows. It talks about the contrast between the greatness of God and us is so big that we can't even grasp it. And then he keeps going on, and it's about God's power and might and the beauty of that. And then it comes to verse 30, and it says, even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. And just as we're closing out, I think it'd be good for us to ask a few questions. You know, are we tired? Is there this sense that we're weary, that we're stumbling along, that we're so busy in our lives, whatever it is, our jobs, our families, our kids, our adventing, Christmasing, there's this sense that we're tired and busy. Is that how we feel? And then the question then is, why? Like, as we're doing that and we're scrambling, what do we hope to get out of that? Like, what do we hope to accomplish in that? And then Isaiah goes, those who hope in the Lord, those who hope in Yahweh, they won't grow tired and weary. Their strength will be renewed. They won't grow weary and faint. And I think for a lot of us, you know, where do we put our hope? You know, do you guys see, have you guys seen the movie Lars and the Real Girl? And it's a brilliant film, and Ryan Gosling is in it, and I know a lot of us don't like Ryan Gosling anymore. It's okay. But he plays the younger brother of this guy, and he's kind of socially challenged and, like, psychologically not all there. And like he socially doesn't even interact with people. He can't even touch them to shake his hands. And then one day he rolls in to his brother's house and his sister-in-law and tells them that he's met somebody. So check it out.
Give this to somebody nice.
Mr. Sunshine.
That new girl's kind of cute, huh?
Something's going on with him. I'm worried.
Maybe he wants to be left alone.
That's not what he wants.
I have a visitor.
Where did you meet this person?
I met her on the internet.
Yeah, well, everybody's doing that now.
You know, Bianca's a missionary.
My little brother is crazy, right? I mean, he's crazy.
If I may, he appears to have a delusion.
What the hell is he doing with a delusion?
She loves kids.
Fantastic.
And it's a great film. But when he first introduces his girlfriend, right, the everyone that knows him is like, but she's not real. Like you love this mannequin. It's not real. And I think when you read scripture, when you hear God's passion for what we're choosing to put hope in idols. He's like, that's not real. It's just a statue. It's a golden calf in money. He's saying, like, have you met anyone who's put hope in money? And at the end of it, they're like, wow, that was a great idea. I was not disappointed at all, right? And he's like, and it's just this longing of you were created to put your hope in me. And when you do, that tiredness, the weariness, the run towards hopelessness, that's not what we were created for. And maybe for us, just picture, let's say 5 years from now. So we're almost at 2012. In 2017, where do you imagine your life to be? Like, what will you be doing? What will you have accomplished? What do you hope to have happened? Let's play it like 10 years from now. So 2022. What in your life will have changed? Where will you be living? What will you be doing? How will you be spending your time? Now let's play that out to retirement. What do you hope to have accomplished? What do we hope to have finished? What will our family look like? What will we be doing? And then the question is, where in all of that, where is our hope? Do we hope in success? Do we hope in stability? Do we hope in security? Do we hope in people? Or do we hope in God? You know, the oldest story in Scripture is the story of Job. And it starts out kind of like this, where Satan, literally adversary, God's adversary, goes to him and says, you know, this guy, you think he's pretty fantastic, but I don't really think so. Because you've given him all this stuff, right? His hope is kind of in the stuff. I don't know if his hope is in you. And God's like, well, I actually, you know, beg to differ. I think his hope. And he's like, okay, but game on. And then so God allows him, and he starts taking everything from him. He takes his cattle, his donkeys, like thousands of sheep, and suddenly everything's gone. So his life savings, his bank account, obliterated. And then goes after his family, the kids. Like, imagine that, the loss of kids and loved ones. And then by the end of the story, he's got boils all over him, and there's no Benadryl. And he's sitting there with, like, broken pottery, scratching himself. And then the story ends with God rebuking Job. Like, do you even know? Do you have any idea? And the story is, and it ends with that Job didn't hope in the stuff God gave him, but he hoped in God himself. And I pray that that will be our community, that our hope won't be in the city, our hope won't be in the things we do, and our talents and our craft. The hope won't be in Vox, the community, because if it is, you'll be disappointed pretty quick. That our hope won't even be in the mission, that our hope will be in God who gifts us all of these things, and we get to participate in it. And then I'll just close with this. So the word for hope in Hebrew is literally wait. And that those that wait on the Lord, they will soar like eagles. And this word wait is the same word. You remember the story of Jacob and Rachel and Leah? So Jacob's running from home, and he's got nothing. He's kind of homeless. He runs into his uncle's family, and he's like, this is fantastic, right? So he moves in, and then his uncle has two daughters. One is not fantastic looking. So it says that Leah has weak eyes. So I imagine either like she's got like one wandering eye, or like she's blind, she can't see anything, or she just looks droopy all the time, right? And then it says Rachel is in the Hebrew, unbelievably hot. That's like the original language. So he falls in love with the one who's unbelievably hot. And so he makes this deal with his uncle. He's like, hey, I don't have money. I don't have anything. I'll work 7 years for you so that I could have Rachel's hand in marriage. And then Jacob's like, okay. I mean, the uncle's, Laban's like, okay. So he works 7 years, and there's this beautiful line. It was 7 years, but it seemed like a day to him because he was in love, right? So 7 years, guy's been like laboring, working 7 years, 7 years. So the wedding comes, oh, good God, finally, right? So they have this celebration, there's the party. He goes in, consummates the marriage, and then wakes up and is like, ah, right? And she's like, who are you? Because I got weak eyes. I cannot see. What have you done? Right? You're not Rachel. And then he goes to his uncle and then waits another 7 years, right? And then 14 years pass. And that word wait is because he loved her. And that's where his hope was. And in the season of Advent, which is this time and this period of waiting, and as we hope And this is what one writer says. The season of Advent means that there is something on the horizon, the likes of which we have never seen. What is possible is to not see it, to miss it, to turn just as it brushes past you, and to begin to grasp what you've missed, like Moses in the cleft of the rock, watching God's back fade in the distance. So in this season of Advent, stay, sit, linger, tarry, ponder, wait, behold, wonder. There will be time enough for running, for rushing, for worrying, for pushing. But for now, stay, wait, and Advent, for something is on the horizon.